Structured Ed Studies and the director of the Bennett Study for Judaic Studies at Fairfield University in Connecticut, and our beloved teacher. Ellen is going to be teaching on women from the Jewish and Christian Bibles. How lucky are we? Ellen, welcome.
Thank you.
We're working with a Torah commentary this morning also, if you need one. There are more in the back. And I have two up here. Does someone do it here? Irene, can I take this one? Please take it.
Especially late 19th and 20th century Jewish history and thought. But way back when I was a college student, I fell in love with the study of the Bible. I took every course at Wellesley College on the New Testament and early church, also on Christian theology. I took the one course we had on Hebrew Bible. And then I went to Yale Divinity School for my master's and really thought that I was going to get my PhD in Bible. And then I became a feminist, and I really wanted to discover women's voices. And I became very frustrated that you don't have many women's voices or even many full stories of women in either the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Bible. And so I decided that I was going to jump to the 19th century, the late 19th century, where we do have many voices of Jewish women. And I think part of my agenda was that if I ever wanted to write a Jewish theology or a Jewish feminist theology, I didn't only want to be able to draw on the voices of Jewish women. And as some of you know, this thinking and then later study, after I got my PhD, would lead to this edited volume, in second revised edition of Four Centuries of Jewish Women's Spirituality. Shira has a piece in that as well. Which is a collection of poems, prayers, blessings, sisterhood minutes. In other words, it's a book not about Jewish women's spirituality, but it's expressions of Jewish women's spirituality. But given my focus on modern Jewish history and thought, I never lost my love for the study of the Bible. And I think I never lost my love for it because even way back when I was in college, I was a philosophy major. I love philosophy. So it was a wonderful major. Philosophy really teaches you how to think. And I go home from college on vacations and, share with my parents some of the philosophical theories that I was thinking about. And my parents couldn't care less. They were like, who cares? One of the things, I went to Wellesley College, one of the big questions is, if you've never seen the president of Wellesley College, does she exist? Now, I still think that is a great philosophical question, but my parents thought it was ridiculous. And then I'd go into the city, and in the city I'd ride the subway, and I would see people, especially reading the New Testament in Spanish. And that's when I really think I fell in love with the Bible, because I realized that you don't have to be a scholar to read the Bible, either the Jewish Bible or the Christian Bible. And in fact, many of the most religious people in the world are people who have never read the Bible. Or if they have, they've read it on their own. In other words, they haven't had the luxury of knowing the interpretations of the rabbis or of the early church or of contemporary theologians. They simply put their own heart and soul into reading what we would call the plain meaning of the text. And so more recently at Fairfield, I actually have come back to doing some teaching in the field of Bible. I should tell you, even when I was at Columbia, doing my work in modern Judaism. I was a teaching assistant for David Sperling at Barnard College when he taught Old Testament, and I also was a teaching assistant for the professor at Barnard who taught New Testament. So I never really lost my love of studying the Bible. Well, we're at a place right now at Fairfield University where we do not have a full-time person teaching either Hebrew Bible or New Testament. I teach at a Jesuit university. We are the only Jesuit college or university in the United States that does not currently have both a full-time Hebrew Bible Old Testament person and a full-time New Testament person. And people retired or left, and the university hasn't wanted to spend the money to replace them. And so 2 years ago, I just couldn't take it anymore. I don't think we are going to hire someone full-time in Hebrew Bible. And so I decided that I would take this course, which was on our books, but I knew had been taught once, but wasn't really, it was taught by someone who knew a lot about Hebrew Bible, but didn't know much about the New Testament. And I decided I was going to teach this Women in the Bible course, and I really was going to focus on the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and the Apocrypha. And I really love teaching this course, and I'm going to do it again in the fall. So when Shira and I talked about adult ed, I thought maybe this is something that you would all be interested in. If I had the time, I would love to be here for 14 weeks, the way I do in school, but I don't have the time. But I thought today we could start with a biblical story that I think most of you probably know. But instead of focusing on Abraham, we're going to focus on Sarah and Hagar and their relationship with one another. Next week, we're going to focus on Jezebel. And I have put up, or by next week, they will apparently be up, but I have set some articles for each on the virtual library. There are some articles posted on each of these sessions. They are not required reading. For those of you who really get interested,
it depends if you want to get credit or not.
There's no credit, there's no extra credit. But I really like these articles. And especially for next week, where you'll see on a virtual library, there's an essay by Janet Howe Gaines, who's a Bible scholar, called How Bad Was Jezebel? And it's a popularly written, I think, really excellent article. Janet is a Bible scholar. And I'm going to have a handout next week. There'll be some readings from that, so don't feel you have to read it. But again, each week there will be some selections up on the virtual library. For this week, I posted some of the readings by Tifa Freimer-Kensky and Bible scholar and engineer research scholar in her book, Reading the Women of the Bible, A New Interpretation of Their Stories, which was a book that came out in 2002. And you'll see in the handout for today, two of the selections here are from Tifa's book. So it's just, again, if it's something that excites you and you want to continue. I should warn you that for the third session, what I'm having put up is a very long chapter. It's about the Virgin Mary, and it's from a book by Maria Warner called Alone of All Her Sex, which refers to Mary, the mother of Jesus, and for Christians, the mother of God. Don't feel you have to read this entire chapter. I love Maria Warner's book. I love this chapter. But again, we'll be discussing some of it, you know, here in these sessions. Because since I am a modernist, what I want to do with these biblical women is, when appropriate, take the study of these women up to the present. And there's probably no better example than Mary, the mother of Jesus. Because if all we studied here was Mary, the mother of Jesus, in the New Testament, we could look for 5 minutes in the New Testament. There are only a few sentences about Mary in the New Testament. But Mary grows as a central figure within Christianity, and again, we will talk about that. And then the last session, we're going to talk about actually two of my favorite women in the New Testament. One is Mary Magdalene, who later Christian authors would say was a prostitute, but when you read the New Testament, you'll see there's no mention of her being a prostitute. She was a disciple of Jesus. And I have put up on the Jewish Virtual Library the archaeologically discovered Gospel of Mary. A Gospel of Mary Magdalene that didn't make it into the So you'll be able to read the English translation of that if you're interested in the virtual library. And we'll also be talking about the story of Martha and Mary in the Gospel of Luke. And I particularly like Martha. But these are sisters who basically are pictured as disciples of Jesus. So we have a lot of different women we're going to look at. But today we're going to look at, again, the women I think that are familiar to you, but really focus on their conflict. So again, even though the stories about them are set within an androcentric context, that is, all of the stories of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament are androcentric. If they focus on men, they are primarily about the male characters and what happens to the male characters. And stories about women are either incomplete or non-existent. There are some unnamed men in the Hebrew Bible, but there are way more unnamed women. Today we're talking about two women who have a name, two women who play an important role in the Hebrew Bible. And yet, often when we teach these texts, when we talk about Genesis 6 and Genesis 21, we don't talk about the conflict between Sarah and Hagar. Now, I do have to say, and I'm going to hand this out, that if we were primarily Christian, or if we were primarily Muslim, I think we would read these stories in a different way. And the handout will point to some of that. But I think, and you know, Sharon can correct me, but certainly the way I was taught the stories of Sarah and Hagar in religious school, and even in college, was to sympathize with Sarah. That Sarah, no matter what she did was right, because she was the wife of Abraham and the mother of Isaac. Right? Whereas Hagar was somehow the woman who was in the wrong. Christian tradition has viewed Hagar much more favorably, and Muslims view Hagar as a princess. She is described as the mother of Ishmael, her son, and Ishmael is considered to be the father of Islam. So, very different treatment of the same person. So, I'm going to hand this out, but instead of looking at the first excerpt, we'll simply read from the Torah.
Sarah was
will see in chapter 6, this is described as
16.
Oh, did I say 6? That's 16. And in 21, we'll see chapter 21, she's described as Sarah's
slave.
Right. So there are two different descriptions of who Hagar is.
Yeah.
16 is chapter 16 in Genesis, verse 1.
Yeah. Is Sarah the same as a handmaid, or is there a difference in that?
I think it's the same. Right? When you say it's the same? I mean, it's a different word. It doesn't use the word in the servant. But
you have to see the Hebrew.
You have to see the Hebrew. That's why I always walk around. That's just pretty easy to see.
Yeah.
Isn't the handmaid really the concubine?
Not necessarily.
Because I thought, like, in the story of Jacob, with the two sisters.
Right. But here's where
they're not described as handmaidens.
That's what handmaids are, they're not married.
Well, let's. I think the Hebrew would be the most helpful.
Yeah. But bear in mind, as we're reading these stories to tell the relationship between Sarah and Hagar, there's a major difference between Abraham's relationship with Sarah and Hagar and Jacob's relationship with Leah and Rachel. First of all, Leah and Rachel, as sisters, are both Israelites. And so they both become inheritors of the covenant, that is, the children of Leah and of Rachel do become part of the covenant between God and the Jewish people. Hagar is not an Israelite.
I was talking about the other two. Zilpah
and
Zilpah.
Yeah, right. Well, their children actually become members of the covenant as well. And so then maybe that's another important difference, that they, we don't know who they are. We really don't know who they are. It's really, that's a good interesting story. We really don't know who those other men are. Okay, well, I want to make sure we have time. What time are we ending today? Okay, so let's look at 16. Who wants to?
Now, Abram's wife Sarah, who had not borne him a child, had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "Seeing as the Eternal has kept me from bearing a child, have intercourse with my slave. Maybe I will have a son through her." Abram heeds Sarai's voice. 10 years after Abram had settled in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarah took her slave Hagar, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram as a wife. He came to Hagar, and she became pregnant. And when she saw that she had become pregnant, her mistress became for her an object of scorn. Sarai then said to Abram, "My wrong is on your head. I put my slave in your arms. No sooner did she see that she was pregnant, I became for her an object of scorn. Let the Eternal judge between us." So Abram said to Sarai, "Look, your slave is in your hands. Do to her as you please." So Sarai so afflicted her that she ran away, and an angel of the Eternal found her at a spring of water in the wilderness, at the spring on the road to Shur. The angel said, "Hagar, slave of Sarai, whence have you come and where are you going?" She answered, "I am running away from my mistress Sarai." The angel of the Eternal said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her ill treatment." The angel of the Eternal went on to say to her, "I will greatly multiply your descendants. They shall be too numerous to count." And the angel of the Eternal continued, "Look, you are pregnant and shall bear a son. Call him Ishmael, for the Eternal has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild ass of a man. His hand shall be against all, and the hand of all shall be against him. He shall dwell in permanent opposition to all his kin." So she called the Eternal who had been speaking to her, "You are El Roy," meaning by this, "Even here I have seen the back of the one who looks upon me." That is why that well, the one located between Kadesh and Vered, is called Be'er Lachai Roy. Hagar bore to Abram a son, and Abram called his son, whom Hagar had borne him, Ishmael. When Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram, Abram was 86 years old.
It was hard for me to follow because I have different translations. I think next week I will bring the flower. But, oh no, next week we're doing two decimals. So.
Do you want one?
Okay, well,
I have a question. Why did the angel of the eternal know who she was? When it said, who are you, where are you going, et cetera, et cetera. One would think if the eternal was all knowing, why did the eternal know of the plan of Hagar escaping from the house?
Right. But there's lots of questions in this text about the actions of God, right? I mean, if God is all-knowing and God is the God of love, why is Hagar even having to go through all of this? And what happens to her, which we'll look at now in Genesis 21, is even worse. So where is God in all of this? But if we focus on the relationship between Sarah and Hagar, why did Sarah want her to go away to begin with? You know what? Sarah was the one who said, "Sleep with my husband," and she slept with Sarah's husband, and she got pregnant and had a child. So what did she do that was wrong? And why is Sarah sending her away? Yeah,
she warded it over her. She was scornful. She acted superior, and she clearly shoved her pregnancy in Sarah's face constantly.
Right,
which was upsetting for Sarah.
Right. I mean, that's basically what it was, right? That Sarah, she was just saying, you know, you're infertile, you can never have a child, and here I'm giving your husband what he most wants, which is a son. Right. Let's look at Genesis 21. So we will, you know, look at all of these Sarah and Hagar stories, but that's it.
Adam, do you want the book?
Okay, so this is Genesis 21, verse 9. Right, so Sarah has a son. She calls him, Abraham names Isaac just as he had named Ishmael. And Abraham circumcises Isaac. Abraham at this point is 100 years old. You may remember he was 86 years old when Hagar became pregnant. So this is 13 years later, he's having a second son. And we'll start with verse 6, which is when Sarah came back into the picture. We do have her briefly in verse 3. It says, Abraham named his newborn son, whom Sarah had born to Isaac. And it does say in 21:1, the Eternal now remembered Sarah. The Eternal did for Sarah his promise. Okay, but in terms of Sarah herself actually being in the story, here we have the verse 6.
Yes. Just a quick question. Was Ishmael circumcised?
When is he circumcised?
Was he?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We didn't.
Doesn't say it here? Or is it
we might have skipped that part. I just didn't. Just so saw it.
I think it's
for Isaac, obviously. Obviously, Isaac.
Yeah. He does circumcise Ishmael and circumcises himself. Abraham and circumcises Isaac.
Okay. Obviously, Isaac.
Something else has happened in between, and I don't remember what it was, but Sarai is now Sarah, and Abram is now Abraham.
Right.
So something else happened between 16 and 21.
Right.
That's
why I did a handout, because it's so much easier when you're... No, I'm happy for us to talk about this. So basically, at the point when God promises Sarah, don't worry, you're also going to have a child, and that's, you know, what she lacks. God changes their name, because in the Hebrew Bible, as in other cultures, a change of name is indicative of a change of destiny. So, according to the Bible itself, Abram, the Bible says it means father, becomes Abraham, which is father of
13.
Bible says that he's father of many nations.
Okay.
That omnization, Abba's father. So he goes from being father to a father of nations. And then Sarai goes from being my princess to Sarah, which, according to the Bible, means princess.
Yeah. Can we just look at that? I mean,
sure.
So page 102.
Oh, good.
At the top of the page, so that page in verse 15, God then said to Abraham, Sarai, your wife, call her Sarai no more, for her name is now Sarah. I will bless her too, and I will give you a son through her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations, rulers of people shall come from her. Abraham fell flat on his face and laughed. It's Sarah, by the way, who's pinned with the laughter, but here we have Abraham fell flat on his face and laughed, thinking, can a child be born to a man of 100? Can 90-year-old Sarah bear a child? Abraham then said to God, if only you would let Ishmael live happily before you. But God said, nonetheless, your wife Sarah shall bear you a son, whom you shall call Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him and his descendants after him as an everlasting covenant. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. See, I have blessed him and made him fruitful and made him exceedingly numerous. He will father 12 princes. I will make him into a great nation. But it is with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear for you at this time next year, that I will establish my covenant. Done speaking with him, God ascended away from Abraham. Abraham then took Ishmael and all his homeborn slaves, and those who had been brought, every male among Abraham's slaves. And on that very day, Abraham circumcised the flesh of their foreskins as God had instructed him. That's earlier in the chapter. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, and Ishmael, his son, was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. That very day, both Abraham and Ishmael, his son, were circumcised. And all the people of his household, the homeborn slaves, and those bought from foreigners, were circumcised with him.
Right. So this is proof here of how hard it is to tell these stories and not focus on the men. Right? Because what you read is really an androcentric text. It begins by, we think, being about God's promise to Sarah. But really, almost everything you read is really about God's promise to Abraham and the covenant that God makes with Abraham. And I think that's part of the difficulty. But for me, it's also what's exciting and even exhilarating about not thinking about the men, about focusing on these women. Well, it's still seen as important, but their stories are woefully underrepresented. Yeah.
Maggie. So, if Abraham is 86 when Ishmael is born, and he's 100 when Isaac is born, what about the story of poor Hagar putting the baby on her shoulder and taking him into the wilderness? Is that, it's here, but it's... it's in this space, but is it supposed to be earlier?
No, that's the story. Okay.
He's got to be 13 years old.
He's a child, it's not a baby. Right. You don't know how old he is.
But if it says Abraham, back to Abraham. If he's 86 and then he's 100.
I'm not sure I would focus so much on the, it'll derail us thinking about the surface details like that. It'll derail us from the essence of the story.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Yeah, let's focus on the conflict between Sarah and Hagar. Let's go to Genesis 21, which I think was on page 132.
Yes.
Again, this is a good exercise in trying to just draw out from the, again, the male-centered text, the stories of women. So Genesis 21:1, this really is the story of the conflict between Sarah and Hagar. It's the most central part of the conflict between them. Yeah, what are we?
Just make a point. Given the importance of the women in the story, there is an important foreshadowing here because Hagar is often referred to as Hamitzrit, the Egyptian. And just as Sarah afflicted Hagar, eventually the Egyptians would afflict Sarah.
Right, so that's when we look at the handout, that's one of the main points that Tipka Farmer thinks he makes. Right, right. And that's part of why she sees Hagar as more central than Jews of commonly assume. Okay, so let's
The Eternal now remembered Sarah. The Eternal did for Sarah as promised, so that she became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the exact time God had told him. Abraham named his newborn son, whom Sarah had borne to him, Isaac. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter. All who hear will laugh with me. And she added, who would have dared say to Abraham, Sarah shall nurse children? Yet I have borne a son in his old age. The child grew and was weaned, and on Isaac's weaning day, Abraham held a great feast. Now Sarah saw the son that Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham playing. She said to Abraham, throw this slave girl and her son out. The son of this slave girl is not going to share the inheritance with my son Isaac. This grieved Abraham greatly on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, do not be grieved over the boy or your slave. Do whatever Sarah tells you, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be called yours. Yet I will also make a nation out of the children of the slave's son, for he too is your offspring. Early next morning, Abraham got up and took bread and water and a water skin and handed them to Hagar, placing them and the boy on her shoulder. Then he cast her out, trudging away. She wandered aimlessly in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was all gone, she cast the child away under a bush. She walked away and sat down on the other side at a remove of a bow shaft, thinking, let me not see the child's death. There on the other side she sat and wept in a loud voice. God heard the boy's cry, and from heaven an angel of God called to Hagar and said, what is troubling you, Hagar? Have no fear, for God has heard the cry of the lad where he is. Get up, lift the boy, and hold him with your hand, for I am going to make of him a great nation. God then opened her eyes, and she saw a well. She went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy to drink. God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became a bowman. He lived in the wilderness of Haran, and his mother took him a wife from the land of Egypt.
And that's really the end of the story. So what's the relationship of Sarah and Hagar in Genesis 21?
Andy, it looks like the relationship of a first and a second wife, forgetting that this was a slave. I mean, I can just imagine this in the United States, forgetting the free and the slave, the first and the second wife, and that jealousy and antagonism between us.
But the second time, when Hagar leaves, does Sarah actually go around? Anyway, right? So actually, there really isn't a relationship in the text itself, because Sarah wants her gone, right? Sarah saw the son that Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham playing. And so she says to Abraham, throw this slave girl and her son out. You know, the first time she throws Hagar out, and God sides with her. But then God feels sorry for Hagar, and Hagar comes back. But this time, Sarah isn't even talking to Hagar directly. Maybe, you know, I'm flipping on what Cheryl said. So the first time when Hagar has Ishmael, she's very haughty and dismissive of Sarah. And maybe Sarah is now being dismissive of Hagar, saying, see, you thought you were so, you know, you were hot stuff because you had a son of Abraham's, but now I have a son as well, and this son is going to be the favorite one. Yeah.
At 90, no less.
Good morning, Cheryl. So a couple of things, and I don't want to, you know, sidetrack us, but I've certainly heard that playing, that there's commentary written that perhaps there was a molestation going on, Ishmael to Isaac. So I've heard text study on that. Second thing is, here's an example of Abraham being willing essentially to sacrifice a son. Not Isaac in this case, but Ishmael, trusting in God that somehow casting Hagar and Ishmael out into the wilderness with a skein of water, that somehow he's going to survive. So again, this trust, but it could be seen as a sacrificing his son.
Yeah, Well, I don't know if you've read my midrash on Sarah and where she is when Abraham takes his son up the mountain, but whether Abraham takes Isaac up the mountain or Ishmael up the mountain, from my perspective, it's all about the trauma that's done to the son. And, you know, as I say in my midrash, I think those of us who think we hear the voice of God telling us to sacrifice our children should at least stop and ask God, have we heard you correctly? Abraham's zeal in taking his son, again, whichever son it turns out to be, I know that the Quran is Ishmael, his zeal in carrying out this commandment so much that, as maybe you studied before, when the angel tells Abraham to stop, you know, the rabbis know that God doesn't simply say Abraham. He has to say it twice, Abraham, Abraham, because the first time Abraham is so busy getting ready to kill his son, he isn't even listening. So, you know, I don't know what rabbis say in some interpretation, but I am deeply troubled by Genesis 22. That's why it's so much easier to focus on these great stories that have to do with men. And I know, I can see I'm constantly having to pull us back now to focus on Hagar and Sarah, which, you know, I guess my first point is there really isn't much in the text itself about their actual relationship with one another. And it does seem that the relationship could have been a good one, but maybe it couldn't have been. Maybe if Hagar, maybe in a patriarchal society, if Hagar had born a daughter, maybe they could have been friends. But when she bears a son, it looks like that's not going to happen. And probably what gets Sarah especially angry is how Abraham is perfectly willing to have a covenant through Ishmael. Right, we don't see Abraham saying to Sarah, oh, too bad you couldn't have a child as well, so that the covenant could be through you. I mean, the text assumes that the covenant will be through Abraham and Sarah, because God says it will be through their children. But if you keep reading, I think Abraham would have been perfectly happy with Ishmael. And that's why Sarah really becomes sort of the disruptor of this story. Right? She isn't going to let it go, because as a woman in a society whose status is largely based on her ability to bear male children, you know, I think she thought it would be okay. And by the way, when I was in graduate school, we read this article by a biblical scholar, E.A. Spicer, who talks about this story in terms of what he called the wife-sister motif, that really, in terms of Sarah's whole behavior, both in Egypt and when Abraham says to Pharaoh, she's really my sister, she's not my wife, you can have sex with her, and really seeing the whole relationship of Sarah and Hagar. And in the ancient Near East, he says, women who were wives could also function as sisters, and, you know, but again, I never bought that to begin with. And I didn't buy it to begin with because I think it may be true that in the ancient Near East there was something called a wife taking on the status of a sister, but that's not how the rabbis read the texts. And therefore, that isn't how Jews have read these texts for over 2,000 years.
And I'll just add, and presumably Sarah's status is then going to be based on Isaac's status, right? So she's worried about the inheritance. So if Isaac becomes sort of the secondary son, she'll become secondary in terms of the familial relationship.
Right. And, you know, since she's the first of the matriarchs, how does she know that the covenant will go through her son? Maybe the covenant will only go through Ishmael. And then where would she be? And more importantly, where would her son be? Right? She's really looking to protect her son, just as Hagar is looking to protect her son. I mean, I find it heartbreaking that when Hagar is in the wilderness with Ishmael, she finds some water, and she doesn't drink some water herself, or even after. Right? The text doesn't tell us that she drank water. She gives the water to her son. So I think both of these women are completely wrapped up in their sons, and I think they see their future as having to do with what happens to their sons.
Yeah.
When you talked about in Genesis 16 that Sarah kicked Hagar out, the text doesn't really say that. She just said she made her life difficult and then Hagar went away. But it's only in the second story that Sarah says to Abraham, get rid of her.
Right.
So, you know, there are two different kind of stories here in terms of that. Also, in the second story, it's implied that Ishmael is young, but we already know he's, from the earlier story, he's already 13 years old. So there's kind of a very difference in whoever the authors are. The other thing I'm wondering about is whether or not there's been ever psychological stories done about sisters who turn around and volunteer to bear a child for their sister who has not been able to bear a child. And what goes on then as that child is growing up? You were the one who carried and gave birth, but you're not the mother. It would be very interesting to see psychological stories and then see whether or not that can be implied here, even though they're not sisters.
Because Hagar is supposedly bearing this child for Sarah,
yes,
as if the child were Sarah's, which of course doesn't work out because Hagar realizes when she gives birth that, no, this is her child. Yeah.
Well, good job. My name is Frank. I've never actually studied the Quran, at least on this issue. So we know that the Muslims inherit or take on Hagar and Ishmael as their founding line. Is that in the Quran? And is the story between how Sarah treated in the Quran on these issues as providing a different, perhaps, light? I just don't know what's stated in the Quran.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone knows. I know that the story of Abraham taking Ishmael up the mountain is in the Quran, and Hagar appears as a princess in the Quran. But I don't know where Sarah is. And of course, if we were going to look at how, and I could ask, maybe I'll ask this week, one of my colleagues at school who is a Muslim, is a scholar in Islam, is a Muslim himself, that if we were going to look at this, we wouldn't just look at the Quran, we would look at the Hadith, which are the sayings. In other words, just as Judaism and Christianity have an interpretive tradition, that's important to look at in studying biblical texts. So if I would say, well, how did Jews look at the story of Sarah and Hagar, it's important to look at what the rabbis say. Same way with Islam. So there isn't just the Quran, but there's also the traditions and what is said in those interpretive texts. And that's where Sarah actually might appear, even more than in the Quran. So if I can find this out this week.
Okay.
Well, Dogo has information on that.
Rabbi
Dogo
on
that. Jim, it just seems to me that in the second story that we've read, that the trigger for Sarah speaking to Abraham is watching Ishmael play. And I think, as a parent, I think she had an insight that it is this little boy that is the danger, as you were talking about. It's through her own son that she will fulfill her legacy. And she sees the power of that by watching this little boy play.
Yeah, and I would just say in relation to what was said about Ishmael molesting Isaac in some way, I don't see evidence of that whatsoever.
There's nothing in the text about that. The expression here is that she sees Ishmael mitzasek. So it's a play. Mitzasek is a play on whose name? Yitzchak, the same root. And so Mitzchak, is he playing as in making fun of Isaac? And so why is it that the rabbis impugn on Ishmael? Why is it that they say Ishmael must be molesting Isaac based on that word? Why do they do that?
I think they do.
It's not in the text at all.
Why do they do that? To justify it. It's a justification, but it's not in the text at all.
The same way that we levy against groups we don't like, we levy all kinds of qualities. It's not a good thing.
And it's, I think it's also
interesting,
but I don't know. I mean, it's also the rabbi, not protecting, but reasserting who the covenant is supposed to go through. So Esau is another person who gets a bad rap by the rabbi. And, you know, you read the biblical text, it's just not there. So I would say the same thing with Ishmael. Yeah, I think it would.
I sort of wonder why this conflict is presented between Sarah and Hagar, because somehow in our studies, my understanding was is that servants belong to the house of their mistress, and anything that they had as in children or whatever were considered the mistress's children. It wasn't that unusual. So I'm sort of wondering why the conflict is set up. If you're a slave, that would be the understanding. I mean, what Sarah originally set up was understandable in the sense that child would then be hers. It would not belong to that slave. It would be considered her child because she's not a wife. She doesn't have her own tent. She belongs to Sarah's tent. So why is that? I mean, is the conflict set for the story, or is the conflict real? I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like that Hagar would assume anything else.
But then she had the baby. I mean, I think, you know, that's it. I mean, that what the text doesn't tell us is how Sarah and Hagar really felt. And that's why looking at stories of biblical women, whether it's the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, we often have to read between lines and fill in the gaps. But yeah, legally, it was supposed to all work out fine. And Ishmael was supposed to be seen as Sarah's son. But once Hagar became a mother, once her breast filled with milk, and she was able to nurse this child, why would she ever want to have this child be known as anything other than her son? You know, and that's the thing with Hagar, that this story of Hagar is so short. We hardly know anything about her. What I know about her is that when she's sent away the first, she doesn't have, okay, Sarah forces her away to run away. You know, Sarah is so cruel that Hagar thinks, I can't put up with this anymore, and she runs away. But why does Hagar come back? We see, you said it. Why does Hagar come back in 16? And even in some English translations of Genesis 16, it's an annunciation, A-N-N-U-N-C-I-A-N-O-C-A-T, right? Okay, a word that is often associated with the New Testament. When the angel Gabriel comes and says to Mary, you're going to have a child, Hagar sees this angel who's a stand-in for God. Hagar literally hears the voice of God, and God is the one who says, don't worry. Things are going to work out. Your son is going to become the father of a great nation as well. So here's a woman who is an outsider. She's an Egyptian. She's not an Israelite. And yet the God of Israel, right, the one God of the world, actually appears to Hagar and tells her, don't worry, Hagar, things are going to work out. At least they're going to work out for your son. That's why I'm so sad that she doesn't get to have some water, because we don't really know what happens to her. You know, and unlike the Quran, which elevates the status of Hagar to a princess, Judaism never does. She's still seen as, you know, if you look at, I don't know how many of you studied this story when you were younger, of the conflict between Sarah and Hagar and Isaac and Ishmael, but, you know, the only way I ever was taught to read this story is that, well, of course Sarah's living now. Of course God is with Sarah, because we're talking about the history of the Jewish people. And in that sense, Hagar and Ishmael are simply outsiders. And as we see in the handout, let's look at the handout where Tim from Primer Kinsky, who is a Bible scholar, even mentions Hagar's name. Right, that Hagar, you know that in Hebrew, Hebrew has no vowel, right? So we fill in the vowels. But Tikhonder Kinsky points out that Hagar can also be read as Hagar, the stranger. Right? So even her name tells us that she is this outsider.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So let's look at reading from Tikhon Parma Kensky. It's on a chapter that she has about Hagar. That's the other. And anybody? I'll read. Yeah, set. All right. Let's come back here.
Is that on the
key? It's the second one. Okay. And the first one was from the Bible, so.
The content of the story of Sarah and Hagar revolves around a man, head of the household, who has all the authority. As always in these biblical stories, names count. The man is Abram, exalted father, the wife of Sarai, the princess, and the other woman is Hagar, which sounds like Hagar.
Well, she means it to be Hagar.
Hagar, the outsider. The two women are dependent on the man's will, but their shared situation does not bind them together. On the contrary, far from uniting them, oppression turns them against each other. Hagar and Sarai are not allies. They vie for the status in the household. The rivalry between Sarai, free wife, Hagar is a slave. Justice would demand that seems to be Sarai. Sarai is the full free wife. Hagar is a slave. Justice would demand that Sarai treat Hagar well. When she does not, we are bothered. Several midrashim try to resolve this ethical issue by finding fault with Hagar, by assuming that she must have done something wrong. They explain that Hagar let everybody see the contempt in which she held her mistress. You think my mistress is righteous? She puts on a righteous face, but clearly God knows that she is not righteous. She has been barren all these years, and I'm pregnant the first night. In contrast, readers today tend to be angry at Sarai, to castigate her for being insensitive to the plight of someone for whom she should have felt both compassion and solidarity.
Do people agree that you're angry at Sarai and reading this text?
Yeah.
No, and you know, the rabbis will say, not only the rabbis not angry at Sarai, but they say that Sarah, like the other matriarchs, really was a prophetess, and she could see the will of God. And therefore, they explain the actions of all of the matriarchs by being able to see in a way their husbands couldn't, what God really had in store for the Jewish people. And, you know, they go on to explain, for example, in the story of Rebekah and Isaac, that Isaac is not just physically blind, but he's spiritually blind as well. And that justifies Rebecca tricking him with Esau and Jacob. But here in this story as well, the rabbis probably did say, you know, that no, she had to send Hagar away because God wanted the covenant to only be through Abraham, Sarah, and their son Isaac and their direct descendants. Yeah. Oh. Where's the mic?
The thread I see through all of these stories is that the woman furthers the plot. You know, whether it is Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, they're the ones who determine that their sons are the ones that are going. You know, of course, Rebecca has two sons, but she's already determined that Jacob is going to be future of the Jewish people. And so when you say that women are treated as secondary characters, I see it so differently, starting with Eve, that the women are the ones that get things moving, that the progression of the Jewish people is coming from the women, and the men are just kind of there. It's funny, maybe that's why it's patriarchal, because the women are so powerful.
Yeah,
good morning. I'm saying some words here long before I move on this. This sounds more like a dispute in a royal house. Sarai burns her name, or she's. This is more like a concern about descendants. I'm guessing very few people really look forward to see how many descendants they want. This is a dispute in a royal house. That is when the real fighting goes on. When the mother rivalry, the sibling rivalry, the battles that go down like almost every generation. And this is what seems to be happening in Sarai and Hagar, and what seems to be passed on down to Yitzchak and Yishmael. And I'm saying the younger son before the older son, which I usually do not do, only because we are sometimes having Yitzchak rather than Yishmael. I'm following like the convention, which actually goes against my usual rule, name the older ones first than the younger ones, because we automatically have a mental block. We see this one as ours and our forebearer, the other one not. I'm saying this just kind of gives this interest to me and probably nobody else. That in some cases in the Near East, in their royal houses, generally, not elsewhere, whether or not someone, a wife, needs to serve the function of sister, it sure as hell was often the other way around. The Egyptian leaders were so concerned about the purity of the royal lineage, which ran through the female, that the brothers married sisters. And in fact, the Ptolemies, the Macedonian Greek rulers of Egypt, followed exactly this. Just a few generations into their royal kingship, they became so obsessed with having to make everything Greek and protect their own Greek, Macedonian Greek purity, that they began to do the same thing. Uncles married nieces, brothers married sisters, and somehow or other, despite the feeble-minded rulers that produced out of this, they survived all the way down to Cleopatra V and Ptolemy XII, the parents of Cleopatra VII. And surprisingly, she stood out, that there's a surprising view that she did not have the center brain damage or the people mind of previous readers, but a very smart person. And the reason I'm saying is that sometimes incest has a stigma, and we often translate a lot of different things. And we often see wives or sisters change trading functions here. It sounds very strange to some people, but if we're describing the situation here, if we understand the Near East, these actually are very much part of human history. But especially in royal houses, I'm saying again, this emphasis here, this behavior seems to struggle in the royal house. And I'm assuming so, additionally because the name is Sarah. But her name also suggests struggle. And she's very worried about whether her line will prevail or not.
Paul, I'm glad Don brought up the idea of the royal house. I only wanted to point out that it's not any different today. If you look in the Middle East and the power of the royal houses in Saudi Arabia and places like Dubai and the other Arab Emirates, the people in charge there have enormous power over our own foreign policy, and I can only imagine what's going on there between the many sons of many wives of various rulers. Be interesting to know.
See, what strikes me is different, though. I know Sarah, supposedly, I mean, even the text itself says she's called Sarai, and she's my princess. But when I think of royal households, I think of many, many wives and many, many children. Whereas this story, we're just talking about one wife, one servant, and two boys. And for 13 years, Sarah is childless, while Hagar has this wonderful son. There's nothing in the text itself, there's nothing wrong with Ishmael. Again, Abraham loves him, Hagar loves him, and I can't imagine what it would be like to actually be in this close-knit household with this child who, according to the law, may be yours, but isn't yours, and his mother, Hagar, certainly knows isn't yours. So I think the text, because the text doesn't have any of that, I think it is hard to remember that these are not, I mean, this isn't like a big population. I can imagine being in a harem. And two children never even get to know each other. I mean, they're 13 years apart in age. But they're really all they have. You know, I'm sure they did play together because what other neighbors were there that they were going to be playing with? There probably were, but the text doesn't tell us. So let's look at the second excerpt from Tipper Farmer Penske. This is actually from a different chapter in this book, Reading of the Bible. Anybody know?
The paradigmatic nature of the ancestor stories of Genesis has long been recognized. The development of the family of Abraham into the nation of Israel is both history and parable. Nachmanides coined a maxim, Ma'ase Avot Siman Baba Min. The deeds of the fathers are signs to the children. Thus, the temporary descents of the patriarchs to Egypt are seen as foreshadowings of Israel's enslavement and emancipation from Egypt. The stories of the matriarchs share this paradigmatic quality, though the rabbis took no note of it. Hagar's slavery, emancipation, and annunciation manifest the pattern of Israel's own slavery in Egypt and her second captivity in Babylon. Sarah's sojourn as a slave in Pharaoh's house, and later in Gerar, foreshadows Israel's slavery in Egypt and her second captivity in Babylon. Rivkin's captivity in Gerar reinforces the hint that there'll be more than one captivity for Israel. And Medina's story demonstrates the intricate difficulties of Israel's destiny among the nations, focusing on the essential question of how Israel should form alliances and how it should grow.
Okay. So she's saying that the rabbis will look at the stories of the patriarchs and see them as paradigmatic, as paradigms that have to do with the history of the Jewish people, but they actually don't do that when they're talking about biblical women. And she's suggesting that figures like Hagar, figures like Sarah, Rebecca, and Dina, that they are also paradigms. And the fact that they are all in some way enslaved and then eventually become free, that they in fact are foreshadowing the history of what will happen to the Israelites, even though, you know, surprisingly for her, the rabbis don't make any mention of this. In other words, what she's saying is maybe Hagar, despite her name, isn't really the outsider. Maybe Hagar is the insider. And that Hagar, that's what she entitles the chapter from which I got my first reading, Hagar, a sister. The idea that Hagar isn't only one of us because her history is part of the history of the Jewish people. But let's look at oh yeah, okay, time. All right, let's look at this last very long excerpt from an excellent article. I don't know how many of you have read the Women's Bible Commentary. The Women's Bible Commentary is really excellent. It looks at Hebrew Bible, New Testament, Apocrypha, and it mostly, it doesn't, to my surprise, when I've ordered this book to use in my Women in the Bible course, sadly for me, it doesn't offer the biblical text. It's just commentary. And sadly for me, because then I had to have my students carry around to every class both the Bible and Women's Bible Commentary, which is over 1,000 pages.
The one to use.
But many of the articles in the Women's Bible Commentary are really excellent. And I particularly like this essay by Elaine James, Sarah, Hagar, and their interpreters. So who can we get to?
The stories of Sarah and her Egyptian slave Hagar are intimately intertwined and desperately conflicted, a conflict which is never resolved. The shadow of their conflict lingers in the history of interpretation. Theological and aesthetic representations alike tend to polarize the two characters and to understand them as symbols for others. Most significant among these is Paul's Christian typological interpretation in Galatians. He describes this story as an allegory. God's promise is through Sarah's son Isaac, who represents birth in the spirit. And Hagar and her son are condemned according to the flesh and driven out. For Christians, this reading strategy legitimized their ascendancy over Jews and later over Muslims. Early Christian readers, though, are not entirely without sympathy for Hagar, for the early church father, John Chrysostom, exemplifies God's compassion and care for the lowly, and the angel's visitation dignifies her abject situation. Rabbinic discussions tend to highlight the ethics of the story. Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai argues that Hagar is Pharaoh's daughter, which both elevates Hagar's status and is occasionally taken as a sign of Hagar's idolatry. Famously, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman accuses both Sarah and Abraham for sinning in their mistreatment of Hagar. In Muslim tradition, Hagar has an esteemed position as the mother of Ishmael and the foremother of the Arab followers of Muhammad. Hagar's story is included in the Hadith, the oral traditions of the Prophet Muhammad. Here, Hagar's tireless pursuit of water for Ishmael and the angelic promise that Allah's people will come from herself ennoble her character. Sarah, too, has a place of esteem in Muslim stories, as she successfully defends her sexual purity when Abraham gives her to other men by pious invocation of the name of Allah. In the modern era, readers focus increasingly on the injustice of Hagar's rejection, and she becomes a representation of oppressed peoples. Perhaps the best example of this is her adoption as a representative figure by African Americans, who note her position as a racial outsider, her slave status, and her theophanic wilderness experience. Contemporary feminist and womanist theologians also have been keen to rehabilitate Hagar, exploring the story's potential to illustrate women caught in alignment distortions of power, especially with respect to patriarchy and race. This discussion often emphasizes Hagar's suffering and her final achievement of liberation and divine recognition. The rift that lingers between Sarah and Hagar continues to speak powerfully to unhealed wounds of all kinds. Poet Alicia Susskind Ostreicher imagines each woman articulating a yearning for solidarity that remains unfulfilled.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of very important things in this essay. And included is the fact that, at the end, the relationship between Sarah and Hagar is never resolved. And they never do come back together. You know, even if only for a moment. There really is never any reconciliation. These two women are clearly in two different places in their lives, and, you know, presumably they go their own ways, and their sons go their own ways, and they don't have... I mean, there isn't much of a relationship here. But the rehabilitation of Hagar, the recent rehabilitation of Hagar, is really fascinating. And I don't know if Jews have done that rehabilitating of Hagar as much as other groups have. Elaine James refers here to feminist and womanist theologians. A womanist theologian is a black feminist theologian. Many years ago, maybe in the early 80s, a number of black feminist theologians said, you know, the feminist movement is by and large made up of white women who always set the agenda. And so both politically and theologically, women who were black, so it's not women of color in general, but black women, decided that they had to claim the name feminist for themselves. And in doing that, there was a suggestion based on the Iowa, who said that? Harry Tubman? Right, ain't I a woman? No, Sojourner Truth.
Right.
So Sojourner Truth, you know, gave this talk in which he said, she was talking about what it was like to not count, to be a slave, and then she kept saying, it ain't I a woman. And so out of that came the term womanist. And so womanist theologians, of which there are many, you know, I'm a member of the American Academy of Religion, we have a whole womanist section, and I really love to go to hear their papers, because it's a combination of feminist theology and black liberation theology. this idea first articulated by Professor James Cohen at Union Theological Seminary in New York, that God is a God of the oppressed. And since, I mean, Jim Cohen didn't come up with that concept, but what he came up with is, if, as liberation theologians say, God is the God of the oppressed, then Jesus must have been black. And he articulates this theology. Again, he's not saying Jesus wasn't Jewish. He's not literally rewriting history. What he's saying is that as a theologian, it's more powerful for people who are black to imagine Jesus, that person who cared for the sick and the low, and the, you know, to imagine him as black. And then womanist theologians said, you know, with all due respect, Jim, if God is a God of the oppressed, then maybe God, we should imagine God as a black woman. And so out of that, and it's true that Jim Cohen, who I really admired as a scholar, did not write much about women, but nonetheless, I really recommend his books to you. In any case, that's how all of this emerged. So to see Hagar as racially different, which she is, to see her as portrayed as the outsider, which she is, as someone who finally does find her voice by the end of the text, even if it's not a conversation with Sarah. So there is an attempt among people to rehabilitate Hagar. And it may be that in Islam, Hagar doesn't even need rehabilitation. That she's always been seen as a woman treated with a great deal of dignity and respect. Yeah.
I think exceptions of the word rehabilitation is a different slant. And to rehabilitate in some ways strikes me as our cultural appropriation of our culture, since Hagar emanates oldest from our scripture than anybody else's, so you're taking our story and converting it into somebody else's story. So I don't like that word rehabilitation. Yeah,
right. But you can see why they wouldn't want to use the word co-optation, which is closer to where you are.
I understand
that, is
that, but that becomes, right, that becomes appropriation, which is objectionable in certain contexts.
Well, let me end. I know I don't have a lot of time, so I want to end. I want to say a few things. I'm going to read a very short poem by Alicia Westreicher. Here's some terms that I didn't get to talk about today that I think is appropriate. David Tracy, who is a well-known Catholic theologian, many years ago, came up with this phrase, the hermeneutics of suspicion. Hermeneutics is an interpretive key, an interpretive method. And he said that when we look at different texts and we see that certain things aren't there that we think should be there, maybe we have to look at the text critically. That is, not look at it reverentially, but see it as a literary work and see what it is that isn't there that should be there. Feminist theologian, Catholic theologian, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenzo, then took the work of David Tracy and she retitled what Tracy had done, starting with a feminist hermeneutics of suspicion. And what Schussler Fiorenzo, who's a biblical scholar, particularly New Testament, but she also writes about women in the Hebrew Bible as well, she said that because these texts are androcentric, we need to read between the lines. She has a very famous book called In Remembrance of Her, which refers to that moment when the disciples are basically saying to Mary Magdalene, why did Jesus love you more than us? And she says, well, why did he not love you more? It's basically a moment in the New Testament where if you read through the lines, read, and we'll look at this, it's not hard to imagine Mary Magdalene as a female disciple of Jesus. In any case, the idea of our looking, as I think we've done today, look at Genesis 16 and 21 through this lens of hermeneutics of suspicion, say, why are these women portrayed in certain ways? Why aren't their stories fully told? And then to take on what Schussler Fiorenzo calls a hermeneutics of retrieval and a hermeneutics of remembrance. In other words, rather than rewriting the Bible, maybe we need to think of ways in which we can remember these stories in a different way. And from there, Schussler Fiorenzo says, we need to create what she calls a hermeneutics of creative imagination. What the rabbis would call midrash. Right? So we take these texts and we imagine how they can speak to us. You know, I don't want to think that Sarah was a horrible person. I don't want to think that she was unjust, despite what the text says. But rather than creating, in every midrash I've written, I'm trying to stay true to the text. I try to create stories out of the text that the text doesn't say, but could have said. In other words, you know, I think that's the difference between interpretation and just doing something out of whole cloth. Well, I want to end with one of the poems from this wonderful book by Jewish poet Elisha Susskind Ostreicher. This book is a collection of poems and prose to accompany the poems. The book is called The Nakedness of the Fathers. You know this book? And here's her poem called The Opinion of Hagar. I have no opinion. I am an Egyptian woman. They sold me and made me her slave. Like everyone else, I was in love with her beauty. She pretended to care for me. Forget about our nationalities. Forget about social rank. She would say, "We are women together. That is what matters to me." She used me. When she couldn't have a child herself, she made me sleep with her husband, that old, creepy man. He's only 86.
Only 86.
Right. So, sorry, I apologize to those who are very sick. When my son was born, she was yellow with jealousy of my round breasts, of my strong, healthy boy. Finally, she too had a son. What a laugh, a thin stick of a baby. He whined and spit up his food all day. Just what you would expect from those threadbare sacks of parents. But that was the end of me. She threw me away like garbage. Hagar, she jeered. Hagar, the stranger. You see how humble I am. My son is another story. In other words, he would be the father of a great nation. Not like me. My son is free and courageous. A wild ass of a man. He can read and write. He can run a printing press. He can shoot an AK-47. I call him Ishmael. I whisper to him, "Fight to your dying breath." But I still wonder, why could she not love me? We were women together. Like this book. Thank you all. The Nakedness of Our Fathers.
One of the wonderful things about the study is it's not only about this particular story, it's about ways of studying and ways of thinking about sacred text. So I wanted just to hover for a moment on something that we're going to continue to do with Hebrew and Christian scriptures. Is that line of appropriation, rehabilitation, and Frank's question. When you travel in, like, Mexico, for instance, and throughout South America, the most likely, if you were to, what locations did the Catholic Church choose for building its cathedrals? Right, the sanctuaries of the Aztecs or the Incas or the Mayans. So they destroyed and then built upon other sacred places, their own sacred places. And if one could excavate beneath the cathedrals, you would find the sacred places of the peoples whom they placed. So we have that angst about the use of our stories, but that's what happens. So to be aware that our stories are going to be used as a foundation for other stories. We're going to see that throughout the study. So we're not going to study the finding of Isaac, which is chapter 22, right after chapter 21, but that Abraham, whether it's the second sacrifice, as Cheryl suggested, that first he sacrifices Ishmael by throwing him into the wilderness, and having done that, he can now sacrifice Isaac. Also see it that way, as a condemnation of, as a replay of Israeli and Palestinian issues today. But the sacrifice, the almost sacrifice of Isaac, will be seen as what's going to be built upon that?
Crucifixion.
So Abraham fails because he doesn't completely sacrifice his favored, his one and only favorite son, but God the Father will succeed in the complete sacrifice of his favorite son. The wood on the shoulder of Isaac will be cross carry, so that the symbols of the story will be used to tell another story in the way, again, graphically, we see the cathedral on top of the Aztec sanctuary. And that part is, sometimes it makes us mad, and sometimes it's interesting. Well, however it makes us feel, it's important to observe it, because that is in the nature of digging for the spirit. And we don't live in isolation, we do that. So just to be aware, and we're going to see that a lot. So at what point is it midrash, and is it, at what point is it appropriation, and can you, maybe we can't distinguish between them. And to step back, just to observe it, I think we saw it also last week in the teachings that Josh and Michael offered, we see that process. But to be aware of it, a literary analysis perspective, and to be aware of how it affects us to read it, too. The last word that Ellen just used wasn't appropriation or rehabilitation, it was recovery. Is that the word? No. There's another word you used, which I prefer to say it that way. I mean, I don't know if it was in something you quoted in your own word, that sometimes it's not rehabilitation, it's recovery. Retrieval. So that's another way to see it, besides rehabilitation, to retrieve what's in there that we haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. And so that's something else that we have a different set of lenses on now, affected by feminist and womanist and all different kinds of thinking in our world, and that gives us the capacity also to retrieve parts of the text that remain buried for so long, which is another way to see. I think for many of us, we have come to see Hagar through the sympathy with which the text writes about her. That the text draws our hearts out toward her. And why would that be? So I think we've also worked together in the act of retrieval and for things that were buried by some of that rabbinic, those rabbinic layers, which suppressed other beautiful and complicated feelings that are part of this text. So I think part of what we do is also retrieval, but all of it, how lucky are we to be studying with Ellen, and we thank you so much. This is the last time we can make this announcement.